From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio, science and technology that is accessible and entertaining. And if we can understand it, so will you. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware-Peak. And this morning we're joined by the director of the Utah Avalanche Center, Chad Brackelsberg, along with forecaster extraordinaire, documentary filmmaker, and other things that we probably don't even know, Trent Meisenheimer, who will talk about the science of a spring snowpack when it's record-breaking like it is. What happens to the slowly eroding snow when it's, when is it hazardous, and how late into the season will we see avalanche?
Then Jason Sills, associate director of the Clark Planetarium, joins us to talk about the 20th anniversary of the planetarium in their new location and all the fun events they have planned, along with events in the night sky that we can experience this summer if the sky ever clears up.
And there's a big question surrounding that. This is Cool Science Radio here on KPCW Park City. Stay with us. We'll be back after these words. Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Lynn Ware-Peak.
And I'm Katie Mullally.
Now, when we think of snow and avalanches, we don't often think about them happening in April, May, or even June or July. But the snowpack changes its structure, it erodes, and as it melts, water further compromises it and can create potential for avalanche. We're joined by two avalanche professionals who we invited on this morning to talk about the science of the spring snowpack. Chad Brackelsberg and Trent Meisenheimer from the Utah Avalanche Center, welcome to both of you. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning.
Yeah, good morning.
Well, let's start here. I mean, which of you is more the scientist?
That would definitely be Trent.
Okay, Trent. I mean, we, Katie and I were talking about this one day and just thought that it would be really interesting to look at a much bigger snowpack that persists. And of course, it started all the way back in October, the formation of the snowpack and how it's going to continue into the spring and maybe even the summer. What concerns and what's different this year about the snowpack?
Yeah, those are all really great questions. You know, I think it's no surprise that we've had a historic winter. I think Alta in Upper Little Cottonwood Canyon right now is reporting roughly 885 inches of snowfall for the year. So to answer your question, I also don't know. We've never seen a record-breaking winter like this, or at least I haven't in my career. Now, what I do know about wet snow or springtime conditions, we can talk a little bit about that. But as far as like this winter and what's gone on this winter, there's definitely been some new things for me. I've learned a lot. And it's been an interesting winter just for just how much snow we've received.
Right. I think that people don't realize that there is some real science behind, involved in the snowpack and in avalanche in general. Anyone who spent any time on YouTube looking at videos of avalanche, it's a phenomenal science, really. How do you at the Utah Avalanche Center, keep up, learn more about the science? What's your ongoing education?
Oh, yeah, that's another great question. So, ongoing education for us is it's really just everything. One, it's just being in the field and experiencing, it snowing or going and looking at avalanches. For me, in my career, I think going and looking at avalanches is the best education you could have because and of course, once they've happened, you don't want to be obviously involved in avalanches. That's really not good. But the, going and looking at these avalanches, you can learn a lot, and then thinking about how that avalanche either was triggered. Was it triggered naturally? Was it triggered by a human? Which way was the wind blowing? Why did the slope get wind loaded? Or, how deep is it? What layer did it break to? So I find a lot of enjoyment about going out and trying to find out what caused those avalanches. And so I think I learn a lot through that. Through the summertime, it's reading a lot of articles. It's going to international snow science workshops like in this fall. I think those are every 4 years, Chad, something like that.
Yeah.
And we read a lot of papers and obviously our colleagues and the wonderful people we work with, we get a lot of experience. Some of our forecasters have 25, 30 years experience and, we learn a lot from each other as well.
And we really have to mention that, avalanche science and snow science in North America started in Little Cottonwood Canyon right here. You know, we have a history of almost 90 years of doing snow science research right here. So we have this amazing history. We have people who literally we are walking on their coattails of what they did back in the 30s. So it's pretty phenomenal. And now with big research institutes at the university and the National Weather Service, all these different groups are continuing those traditions of really looking at how can we continue to innovate using not only what Trent's talking about of understanding what's happening physically, but looking from computational models and using artificial intelligence to see how can these new technologies all help us predict avalanches, predict snow behavior, understand what's happening, and to just give us more tools in our toolbox. So pretty amazing how technical the field has become.
You're just joining, go ahead.
Oh, and I was just gonna elaborate on that too. Yeah, it gets really complicated. I like to say actually avalanche science becomes, I think it's harder than rocket science in a lot of ways, because what you have is you've got time that's always continually ticking on, but you have temperature and all these different variables that are changing, not hour by hour, it's second by second. And you know, when you look at say like an iron beam, we can take that iron beam and we can stretch it and bend it and heat it, and we can do all these engineering tests on that beam to understand how it breaks. Well, now you take that same beam and you literally just make it change every second on you in a different way, and now it becomes a liquid, now it becomes a solid, now it becomes brittle or elastic or plastic, all that, that it just changes all those variables, and that's what the snow does. And so unfortunately, it's not an exact science, and we're still learning a ton about the snow. And as Chad said, there's a lot of research going on that's really exciting.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we are talking with Chad Brackelsberg and Trent Meisenheimer of the Utah Avalanche Forecast Center and the science behind this year's snowpack. So, talking about steel beams, we have a, 800-inch steel beam sitting up on the mountains up there. In years past, I've seen you guys dig through the snow, analyze the snowpack, the layers of it, the stability of it. What are the challenges you're facing when you have 800 inches up at Sundown or up at Alta?
Well, you know, luckily all that snow didn't come in at one shot. So it's been coming in since about October, nonstop snow. And that snowpack changes a lot over time. So what ends up happening is as that snow settles, it begins to bond and sinter is what we call it, meaning it creates bonds with those individual snow grains. Now it can be a good thing because it creates more strong snow, but if you have weak layers in the snowpack, that's then where we get avalanches, is where we see strong snow on top of weaker snow. It's been a busy winter with avalanches because we've seen so much snow. But as that snow progresses through the winter and it begins to sit down more and more and it bonds and it centers, and actually it's called, the temperature in the snowpack actually really is what allows those snow grains to really bond together. And what we end up seeing is actually a homogeneous snowpack. Right. And so that homogeneous snowpack actually becomes stable over time. But this winter was one of those winters where it just wouldn't stop snowing. And so it was like, you know, the glue never actually set, right? Like it just kept peeling off these layers of snow because it just didn't ever have time to adjust to how much snow we've gotten.
And what does that really mean for us if we want to go riding is we've all been out there on 6 inches of fresh powder and you're riding basically on a hard base underneath because it's just not supportable yet. But as those changes happen, you feel the day after the storm, all of a sudden it's a little more supportable. It actually rides a little better and it's a little more fun. And then as time goes, that continues to become more supportable. Then we add more snow on top of that, bringing us really right to where we're at right now with what we call the spring snowpack, which is, you know, a much different snowpack, right? You don't have these amazing soft, fluffy layers on top, other than the fact that it's snowing outside right now.
Little fluff out there.
Little fluff maybe today, but for the most part, spring snow is a lot more fun snow. It's easier to travel on. You're not getting face shots, but you can do a lot more things on it, go a lot into a lot bigger terrain.
Well, Chad, you were talking about how avalanche science has been around since the 30s. But this has been such an epic year, and you learn every year, you use the old technologies, the old methods. Has there been something about this year that you've learned or a technology that you've developed that will be kind of a new benchmark going forward in avalanche forecasting?
I'll let Trent comment on the forecasting side, but it's been uncharted territories all season, and whether it's our staff out there trying to predict the dangers and what's going to happen when really it just doesn't have those times to settle out and it just keeps snowing, or organizations like our ski resorts in UDOT, where if you drive up Little Cottonwood Canyon, you know, it's historic levels. There's nothing to slow down slides on the big slide paths anymore. The trees are all buried, everything's gone. And so, yeah, they're learning every time they do control work. It's they're just like, well, wonder what's going to happen today, because no one's ever seen this. So it's resetting the bar on what the standard is of what might happen on a big snow year. And Trent, from, you know, what have we learned daily in our forecasting from this season?
Yeah, you know, this year, as Chad just described, it's been tough to keep up with the amount of snowfall. And, you know, a lot of times we've just, when it becomes dangerous, you got to take a step back from those mountains. You got to let the mountains are in charge, right? Like, we can visualize and try to understand what's going on. But I mean, when we've had avalanche paths this year taking out mature timber, we're seeing avalanches run, you know, further than we've ever seen them before. And so I think, you know, patience for one thing is something that I've learned more this season, as well as just like stepping back and letting the mountains kind of do their thing and not trying to overanalyze, you know, too much. Meaning, you know, our boss, Mark Staples, he's always saying in our meetings and stuff, he goes, you know, he's like, let me get this straight. Like, more snow, like, there's a couple of rules of thumb, right? More snow will always equal more avalanches. And so same with the wind. The more wind we get, and if we have snow available for transport, we're going to see the danger increase and avalanches increase. And so that's really been the name of the game this year. It's kind of almost, it was predictable in the way that we knew it was dangerous. But I don't think I really had much of a handle on, you know, what we were going to see, because it was just so much snow this year. So again, it was just stepping back a little bit more this season.
It seems like we did not have a persistent weak layer. However, like, the snow came, and this is just my casual observation, but the snow came and it never really stopped. We never had 3 weeks without snow that would create that weak layer. Is that true, Chad? And did that make a situation that could have been really, really bad not as bad?
You know, we did have it early in the season. We had that October snowfall, I believe it was maybe October 24th when we first started getting snow. And it snowed for a week or so, but we had a period in the middle of November that was very dry and extremely cold. I don't know if people remember, but early November, it was in the single digits, some wind chills below zero. We did develop a pretty bad persistent weak layer at that time. It became buried starting just after Thanksgiving when it started snowing. But what happened that was so great is it just didn't quit snowing. So normally we would get a little bit of snow and a little bit more, and then we go, as we like to say, high and dry again. And that's when that persistent weak layer really plagues us with high avalanche danger. But this year it became buried so deep so quickly. Yeah, there's still places with well over 8 or 9 feet of snow, even at, you know, mid elevations right now. And so those layers just disappeared pretty quickly. And new problems occurred, as Trent said, that we just weren't necessarily ready for. But yeah, we definitely had less of that persistent weak layer problem then, especially than last season, when people might remember it snowed early on, it didn't snow, and then it literally didn't snow most of January and February. So it was a super unique year last year. And now look at this year, you know, we went from 60% of average snowfall roughly to 220% of average. So really some extremes that we've seen in two seasons.
About 10 years ago, maybe, in one of our last big years, I walked out at City Park out of Miners Hospital. I was at a meeting there, heard a noise, and looked up at one of the runs on the front of Park City, maybe next to CB's or something. And it was in the spring. It was a very warm, beautiful afternoon. The daffodils were out. And we watched the entire thing rip to the ground and just move down sort of slowly. I'm sure it wouldn't seem slow if you were up on it, but it makes me want to ask about what happens when the water penetrates all the way to the ground and sort of erodes the snowpack. Are you seeing, will we see lots of that ripping to the ground?
Yeah, and that's, you know, good question, because I guess my answer would be, I don't know yet. We'll have to wait and see. But what I can say is that, you know, up to about April 5th, okay, so that would be 15 days ago or so, we were still in a winter snowpack. It was snowing every couple of days. That was right when I think Little Cottonwood Canyon was shut down for almost a week straight. I think Alta recorded something like over 60 inches of snowfall in 5 days or something. So we went from a winter snowpack, and then April 5th, the sun came out. Now, April sun is strong. Okay, it's going to put a lot of heat into that snowpack. And, you know, the snow is a lot like people. It doesn't really love rapid changes. So when you change the variables quickly, the snowpack usually reacts because it's always trying to reach an equilibrium. Now, when that snow first took in that heat, we saw some of the bigger avalanches. Now, when the snowpack gets heated from sun or warm temperatures, we really see two types of avalanches. And that's really important to understand that there's different avalanche types or avalanche problems. And there's really two types when it comes to spring. There's one just that we call a wet loose avalanche. And basically the way to think of that is just it starts at a little point somewhere on the mountain. And as that snow starts to move down, it just continually collects more and more snow with it. And it starts to fan out. And if it's a long enough slope, this thing can be quite dangerous because it can pile up a massive amount of snow. You know, we're talking a mountainside can be a couple thousand feet long. So this one snowball could turn into a basically an ocean of snow. And then the other type of avalanche that we deal with in the spring is what we call a wet slab. And I can't go too much into it because we really actually don't have a good handle on wet slabs. What we do know about wet slabs is when the snowpack sees that first warm up and we know that it's going to heat that winter snowpack, there's always a possibility of these wet slabs. And right about April 5th or just after, the Provo mountain range went off with these wet slabs. And for why it did that there and less so up here, where in the central Cottonwoods, Ogden, Salt Lake, we saw more of the wet loose types of avalanches. But in Provo, Cascade on the west side, we saw giant wet slab avalanches. And what I mean by that slab is like an entire plate of snow just ripping off the side of the mountain at once. And then it really does create these massive debris piles that, you know, took out trees, ran historic distances. I mean, it gouged the land out and like reshaped land. I mean, it was quite unbelievable for that first week there.
And Lynn, that's exactly what you saw, was a wet slab. So they're gouging, they're huge, they're massive, they move fairly slowly, like you said, unless you're on it. Where if you look around, and it's a great time to see the difference right now, those wet loose, they look more like an upside down funnel. You might just see that funnel that spreads out over the slope, and it looks like it just started from one little snowball coming off a rock or a tree. And they're all over the mountains right now. You can see that.
Well, as spring comes, eventually, and we all want to get out, whether it's on any trails that might be exposed or actually up skiing again on the mountains, and when they close, what do we need to watch out for? Because during the season, we get so used to the resorts blasting, taking care of avalanches, but I think this time of year, we forget that they aren't doing that anymore. And we were talking earlier about the amount of cornices that are building up, like even daily chutes. So when we're up on the mountains this spring, what can we do to watch for avalanches?
Well, let me start real quick before Chad. I'll let you talk about how to travel and navigate some mountains. But just to be clear, so that first warm-up that we talked about, that's when we're going to see almost all of these wet avalanches occur. Now, once the snowpack is warmed up and it's actually become more of a spring-style snowpack, what happens is the water will percolate through the snowpack and it creates drainage columns. And that water will run down and hit the ground and eventually, you know, drain out into a creek. And once we develop that plumbing, the snowpack becomes very stable. Once again, it becomes homogeneous, meaning it's the same temperature throughout. We call it an isothermal snowpack. So basically, the entire snowpack is 32 degrees Fahrenheit. And so that's a little bit more where we are now. Like, we saw the big heat up, we saw those big avalanches as a result, but now that we've kind of had the snowpack go through that big change, and now we've refroze that snowpack, overall, our snowpack right now, like if you look at our Utah Avalanche Center forecast, we're at a low avalanche danger today. And that's because that snowpack is really frozen in place. And now I'll turn it over to Chad to talk a little bit more about traveling and what to expect in the spring. But from a snowpack perspective, at least today, it's pretty locked up out there.
And what's great about that is that's the corn skiing we all like. It goes through enough of these cold nights, warm days to where it becomes supportable, and then we get that great corn that's so fun to ski on in the spring. As Katie mentioned, most of the resorts are either closed or closing soon, so that does mean that they are now backcountry terrain. So you do need to treat the resorts once they're closed just like you would anywhere else, meaning you need to know how to travel on avalanche terrain. You need to understand the dangers. You need to know how have your rescue gear. You have things like we mentioned daily chutes. They've been controlling daily chutes all winter, but now with Deer Valley closed, eventually those cornices have the potential to heat up and break off and naturally slough. They're probably not going to cause a big avalanche, but if you are climbing up one of those slopes and that those cornices break, it has the potential to definitely be devastating for you and your party. So you need to treat that terrain, like it is avalanche terrain. And other than that, we go from a winter snowpack when we typically think of the north side of the compass. So anything we might ride on that's northwest, north, and northeast as being the more dangerous slopes. And now in the spring, that actually reverses. And so now you look at using the sun to your benefits. So getting out in the morning and those east slopes heat up first, so that's where the good corn is first thing in the morning. And once that becomes too warm, you're going to notice, because as you're skinning up or as you're riding your sled or as you're just walking, you start sinking in further. It becomes really mushy, mashed potato style snow. So then you start moving to the south aspect and then to the west, and then you can end your day back in the north, because just enough of the warm air will make those norths good and soft by the end of the day. But first thing in the morning, they're going to be frozen solid and what we would kind of call slide for life conditions. So using the sun to your benefit this time of year is really a great way to travel for the best riding, but also to stay safe.
So assuming that there's going to be snow left over from the year, which I think we're all in agreement that there'll still be snow in September, when next winter rolls in and the new snow starts to pile up on top of the old snow, does that increase an avalanche hazard?
My guess is it'll probably all melt off. Maybe some of the upper cirques will hold some of that snow. But really, no, that snow that is on the ground, it'll be solid snow. So it'll be just like the new snow falling on solid ground. Now, what could change a little bit is, terrain roughness is really important. So if you think about a slope and it's covered in rocks and trees and stumps and everything, a foot of snow, it really can't avalanche because it's so rough, like the ground, right? But if you have a really smooth slope already and then you add a foot of snow to it, you could start to see how that snow would slide on that underneath layer a little bit easier because of friction. But I would say overall, that wouldn't concern me too much at this point.
I'd be more concerned that there's still snow on the ground in September.
Yes, I would be too, because I'm waiting for that crest trail to dry out. We'll see if we can actually do some mountain biking up there. But I do want to add one thing to kind of the spring here. As far as the spring snowpack and some spring dangers, we're really sad to report that, we had a resident out of the Brighton area killed by a roof avalanche just here Monday, April 17th. It was a local homeowner went to check on their family cabin. We don't exactly know what happened, but they were fully buried because the roof actually avalanched and landed on them. And this is now, there was a really close call in Upper Little Cottonwood Canyon with, I think, a nine-year-old boy.
Yes.
And then we've had another, we just learned on kind of March 20th, another homeowner in Brighton got almost fully, if not fully buried by their roof, but survived. And so I would say, I'm just looking out the windows here and I see plenty of snow on roofs all around here. And, it doesn't take this massive amount. I mean, even a chunk the size of this desk right here that we're sitting on is enough. If it falls from 20 feet, it could be a big problem. So I would say as we start warming up, one of the, in these mountain towns, and If you have snow on your roof, don't let those, you know, kids play outside and play underneath those roofs, and really watch yourselves for any of that falling snow around up here.
That's a really good point. Thanks for the reminder, because again, we start to think it's spring and we think it's melting and it's warm, and we don't think about our roof sliding at this point. A lot of roofs are clear. My roof up in Brighton Estates is clear, but it's just because of what the roof is made of. But still plenty of snow on roofs all over. I wanted to ask about I forgot what I was going to ask about, but I have so many questions now. Oh, I know what it was. Corn snow. It's funny, all the years I've lived here, I don't really know exactly what makes the perfect temperature for corn snow. And I want to ask both about for alpine skiing and crust cruising for those Nordic skiers out there. I'll go out and either I've hit it too late and I sink through and it's horrible, or I go out too early and it's still bulletproof. Is there a sweet spot? And I know you talked about the different aspects, but is there a rule of thumb?
I'll let Trent comment on if there's a rule of thumb, but you know, corn is really hard in Utah. It is, we're low in latitudes and we have such strong sun that our corn season or our corn time frame on any given day can be as short as 30 or 40 minutes almost. And so you do really have to nail it. And it does also depend on the year. A lot of times our mid elevations are usually melted out by now. And so I think this year is going to be a phenomenal corn season year because we have such good snowpack across the realm. But really it takes a number of freeze thaw cycles. So cold nights, warm days. It's snowing today. It's going to take 2 or 3 days for corn now to form up after it snows. And it does like that really good direct heat. And, the time-wise is start early and assume that you don't want to miss it. So you might have to sit at the top of your favorite peak and wait for the corn to ripen, as I like to say, because it can go really quickly from bulletproof to perfect corn to mush. And it's a short window, but it is all about those freeze thaws. The later you go in the year, the shorter that cycle can be because it gets much warmer, that sun gets much brighter. It's hard to time perfectly. I can't actually comment for the crust cruising because I don't do it.
Oh, Chad, you're missing out. It's a great thing to do when they stop grooming. Just go wherever you want, and with all fence posts buried still, it's a great time to go out. So, okay, what else have we missed here? We're about out of time, but were there any other items you wanted to mention?
No, I would just say that the Utah Avalanche Center, we're starting to kind of wind down our season. But I think it's important for everybody to know that, if you're on steep slopes and there's snow covered, by a steep slope, I mean something greater than 30 degrees, you still need to have beacon shovel probe. You need to travel with a partner. You need to know what you're doing out in the mountains for sure. And just because the Avalanche Center closes down doesn't mean avalanches won't happen. And I think that's really important to remember as we go into these summer months, that we're going to be running into snowfall up in those mountains where in normal seasons we might be on our favorite hiking trail and it'll be dirt. So mm-hmm. I do think that is something going to be different moving into this season.
And in the local community here, really think about, as I mentioned, there's a lot of mid-elevation snow still. And so think of what's above you. As you're out walking the dog, even if you're just up in Daly Canyon, you are actually an avalanche terrain and you do have the potential of being subject to these wet loose or wet slab avalanches. So kind of understand, as Trent said, being an avalanche terrain is being on a slope greater than or equal to 30 degrees, but it's not always on the slope. You might be below it. So look up and see what's above you. And if you're walking in a deep ravine and it's really hot out and you're sweating and you're in a t-shirt and there's a lot of snow, you should be cognizant of the fact that you could be putting yourself in danger. And so just because there's not a danger rating does not mean there's no avalanche danger. We will continue to have observations posted and you can always check the weather. So still use those resources, and we want everybody to be safe during the whole spring because we have a lot of winter left here.
Mm-hmm. And if you're one of those people who doesn't own an inclinometer and doesn't know, you know, how do I know if it's 30 degrees? There are free inclinometer apps on your phone. You take a ski pole, you put your phone on the ski pole along the slope of the snow, and I think they're really accurate, right? And then if you keep doing it, you get your own ability to judge what a slope angle is. Can you guys take a look at a slope and know exactly what the angle is?
Yeah, you know, to a certain degree, maybe plus or minus a couple degrees, but I like to call those our avalanche eyeballs. So where we start to learn more about the terrain and we start to be able to say, oh, I'm in a spot here that I don't like. So we can always move and navigate that terrain. But yeah, you're totally right with an inclinometer, but also take it with a grain of salt. You know, like I wouldn't be like, oh yeah, we're right at 30 degrees, you know. Give it a few degrees plus or minus on both sides of it.
That's right.
And you know, Trent, all I could think about is with Lynn's explanation, maybe we should get her to start teaching avalanche classes for us.
Perfect. She's hired next fall.
Okay. Always looking for a new job. All right. Chad Brackelsberg and Trent Meisenheimer of the Utah Avalanche Center. Such great information. Thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And we will be back after this. We're switching from the snow to the universe with talking about the wonders that we see up in the sky when we return.
Welcome back to Cool Science Radio. I'm Katie Mullally.
And I'm Lynn Ware Peak.
The mission at the Clark Planetarium in downtown Salt Lake City is to inspire and engage curious minds by connecting people to the wonder of the universe. For more than 50 years, the Clark Planetarium, formerly the Hansen Planetarium, has been Salt Lake's go-to destination for visitors of all ages who want to discover and learn about space and science. This summer marks the 20th anniversary of the Clark Planetarium. To celebrate, they are offering a wide variety of science and astronomy-themed events to get people excited about science, space, and of course, astronomy. Joining us now is Associate Director Jason Sills. Welcome to Cool Science Radio.
Hi, welcome, or thank you so much for welcoming me. It's wonderful to be up here in Park City on this beautiful snowy day.
Well, 20 years, I remember when you guys were first building out that space at the Gateway, moving from the Hansen Planetarium. First of all, give us an overview of why 20 years, this is such a big deal for you guys, other than just the round number.
Yeah, absolutely. So we have been in the community since 1965, which is a very big deal for us and for Salt Lake. I mean, it's not a lot of places that have a planetarium in their community for that long. We did move in 2003 to the Clark Planetarium. And one of the things that we are really recognizing is that a planetarium is far more than a theater. Right, we have a wonderful dome theater that shows great shows. We have the IMAX theater, but what we've recognized recently is we really need to get out into the community and serve everyone. We need to get everybody that can possibly make it in into the planetarium, but we also need to get out into the field. And so what's really important for us with this 20 years is, you know, recognizing all of the great things that we've done in the past, but also finding those new opportunities to create value for everybody.
I remember when I was much younger going to the Hansen Planetarium for the laser shows, the Pink Floyd laser shows. And when most of us think of a planetarium, we think of the laser shows, the dome where they show the IMAX movies, maybe the models of the solar system. Mm-hmm. But the Clark Planetarium has so much more than just space-related, you know, events. What else do you guys offer the community?
Yeah, absolutely. So I love that you started with our mission statement. Because, you know, our goal is to connect people with the universe. And everybody connects with the universe in different ways, right? So, like you said, we have the shows inside, but we also have, at Wheeler Farm, we have telescopes on the clear nights on Fridays, and you can actually go out, see the night sky live through a telescope. We also have different events going on that we host at different places at different times, and sometimes we would be launching a rocket or we would be doing science demonstrations of some kind. And then we also have things that are fun in building. So in just a couple of weeks on May the 4th, we will be celebrating Star Wars. So it will be kind of our science fiction day. So there's all kinds of ways that we really help people to find the way that they want to connect, be it with science fiction and art, be it with telescopes, be it with learning more in-depth astrophysics.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're speaking with Jason Sills. He is the Associate Director of the Clark Planetarium in downtown Salt Lake City at the Gateway. And it's funny, every time I go to say Clark Planetarium, I think I'm going to slip up and say Hansen Planetarium. What was behind the name transfer? Was it just a matter of who funded it?
Yes, so the Hansen Planetarium was started by the Hansen Foundation. And then as we moved and we pivoted, we moved to the Clark Foundation, and then we still have the Hansen Dome. So if you go in and you look at the dome, that is actually called the Hansen Dome. I have that actually same challenge that you have, mainly because, so I've been in this role for about 6 months now, but I was a lecturer for about almost 4 years at the Hansen. And so I was there in that building, able to do that, and now I'm back, so I share that same challenge that you have.
Oh, good. Okay, so you'll forgive me if I say Hansen. So talking about, well, May 4th, you didn't say the title, so I just have to say it, May the 4th be with you, which is pretty catchy. Do you do that every May 4th?
Every May 4th. It's a very big event. This year it will be from 4 o'clock to about 7 o'clock at night, and we will actually have FanX there emceeing a costume contest.
That sounds like a blast.
It will be.
And like you say, Jason, you know, the difference in how we all find our fascination with the universe, with the cosmos, with the night sky, it's all varied. And I think a lot of people, you know, did find their fascination through something like Star Wars or, you know, science fiction. And what a great thing that you include all of these different things. It's not just about looking through a telescope. However, looking through a telescope is pretty exciting. And you have another upcoming event, I believe, with sort of a famous astronomer.
Yeah, absolutely. So the week that's coming up, we're calling it Full Steam Ahead. And STEAM stands for science, technology, engineering, art, and math. Those are really the five ways that we think, you know, we can really help you engage with the night sky. So that week we are with space science in general, if you will. So that week we are showcasing all five of those. On Thursday, we have the art side. That's that May the 4th be with you. On Friday, we have a famous astronomer named Phil Plate coming in. Tickets are still on sale. You can buy them online. On our website. Phil is a great guy. He has been writing books for about 20 years. He hosted the PBS series Crash Course online, if you would like to check that out. Wonderful resource. It's on YouTube. He has a brand new book coming out called Under Alien Skies, where he's offering a really engaging way of bringing people and helping them understand astronomy, a lot of the new cutting edge things that are happening. And so he will be there at 7 o'clock on Friday night, May the 5th, and he will be offering a talk about all of those new, great, exciting things going on, and we will have the King's English Bookshop there selling books for him to sign.
Speaking of astronomy, I have to admit, I love the store that you guys have at the Clark Planetarium, because when I started into amateur astronomy probably 20-plus years ago, going to the store and having the experts there that could help me buy the right telescope, the right filters, the right lenses. If you're looking at starting an astronomy program for yourself or your family, I highly recommend going down there. Do you train your people at the store in specifically astronomical tools.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. If anybody is looking to get into astronomy, absolutely stop by the Clark Planetarium. We have shows for you where we can help introduce you to the night sky. We can help get you out into the field and actually look at a telescope before you purchase. And you can sit back and talk with somebody for as long as you'd like about really finding that telescope that's right for you. You know, I do think a lot of people have this, I think it's a misconception that astronomy is very hard to get into and it's very expensive to get into. And just like anything else, you can ease your way into it. And, you know, by going out at night and just looking up and learning the night sky tonight, if it is clear where you are, you can see Venus. And then you can identify the winter triangle very easily. And then you can start looking at, do I want binoculars? Do I want a telescope? And by all means, come in and use the planetarium. Exhibits are always free. The shows do have a ticket price, but you can come in. You can learn a lot at very, very low cost to you and be out observing immediately.
And let me just warn you that you will be getting the binoculars and the Dobsonian telescope, and then you'll get all the filters, because once you learn the value in each one of these tools, you want to have it in your own toolbox.
So that leads me to my question, and maybe Katie, you can in part answer this. I go out, when I go camping, that's the time where I see the night sky the best. It's the clearest, and we're away from light pollution. And you know, we'll have binoculars. I can't hold them steadily enough to really see something. And so you said you started with binoculars, Katie. What does the average person, you know, say, I just want to have a little telescope to go out, take with me camping. What am I going to spend?
I would put it in the ballpark of $500 to $1,000. Dollars roughly. Now, there's a lot of different ways that you can go. You can go up from there, but that's probably about that range that would be in that introductory side. Now, there is a trick with binoculars. One, you could actually go and get either a tripod, right, and actually put them on there, or just hold them and rest your elbows down, because really that's where a lot of the shaking is coming from, is from your arm. If you actually go on the hood of your car, put your elbows down on that hood, it'll really give you some stability. And you can start looking at things like the moon a bit easier, some of the planets, things like that. So there's always little hacks that we can do when we're in a tight situation.
That's great. Good to know. Binocular tripod. Who would have thunk? Okay, so let's move on to Saturday. This is sensory-friendly Saturday, and I'm wondering which component of STEAM this one is.
All of the above.
Okay.
And so what you will be doing is actually coming in. So anybody who is sensitive to a lot of sound, a lot of, you know, sight, anything like that. We are first Saturday of every month. This is not just for STEAM at full steam ahead. Every first Saturday of every month, we offer a time in the morning for people who might have those sensitivities to come in and enjoy the planetarium.
Wow. That's important to see, because when you go into a planetarium, it's very focused on lights and visuals and stimulation. And so to have you guys adapt your programming for people, kids that might be a little sensitive to it, it's an amazing thing. Thanks for including them.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, again, we are constantly trying to think of ways that we can help everybody across the community, no matter who they are, to really find the way that they are, again, wanting to connect with the universe.
So as part of this 20th anniversary, you have the Through Space and Time Gala. Tell us more about that. I'm intrigued. Do we get to get dressed up?
Absolutely, you get to get dressed up, and you get to go to an amazing place called COSM. So COSM is actually kind of the parent company of people who make actually the Digistar and things like that that go into domes. They have a brand new technology, though, that has this, it's a very large half dome that is LED, so it's extremely bright. Very good detail, amazing imagery, and you would actually get to go in and sit under that tapestry of the universe. We're going to have those images up like you would have in a normal planetarium, dine under those under the stars. We will have somebody there who worked on the James Webb Space Telescope. He will be our keynote speaker. His name's Scott Willoughby. Phil Plait will actually be joining for a meet and greet beforehand. It'll be a great night. We will actually also walk through kind of the history of the Hansen Planetarium and then the transition to the Clark and where we're really going in the community.
Oh, that sounds like so much fun. How much are tickets?
There's an early bird right now. It's $150. And again, this is a fundraising for us. So all of this, all of the extra is there. Any fundraising we do is there to fund field trips. So you will be helping the community, helping those people out there connect with the universe. And so they're $150 right now. And then about a week before that, we will have, it'll go up to $200. So if you're interested in going, please go to our website and you can actually buy tickets right there.
Great. Okay, so you have among your talking points how to enjoy astronomy in Utah. And I'm just curious, I mean, as I said before, to me, it's when I go camping. Mm-hmm. But what are the ways that you're going to suggest how to enjoy, and especially how to get turned on to it?
Well, the thing I would really like everybody to really appreciate is where they live. You have access to some of the darkest skies still in the United States. Across the world, you know, I mean, as we have these wonderful, beautiful cities growing, the challenge there is that all of that light is going up and crowding out the starlight. And so we have a lot of people alive today who have never even seen the Milky Way, right? So what I would love everybody in Utah to understand is that that's a tremendous resource. You don't have to go very far to get extremely dark skies. So again, before you even think about, like, do I need a telescope and all of that, drive out where it's darker and just look around. Look around, take some notes of things. You can Google around, and, you know, even get an app, right, that helps you look up and see, like, what am I actually looking at here? That is really a great way to go out and connect with the night sky. Then start getting into those telescopes, binoculars. But anybody that's going out camping, keep in mind that you've got to, you know, you've got your day of hiking, you've got your day of sightseeing. Go ahead and bake in some time to go out at night or early in the morning and look at the night sky, because you're really able to do something that fewer and fewer Americans are able to do.
Yeah, growing up as a kid, we were always out camping in the Uinta Mountains, and always had the old-fashioned star chart where you'd have to spin it with where you were located and what time of night it was. It was so much fun. But as people start to go out into the night sky, what are some things that especially beginner astronomers can appreciate coming up this summer that they don't need binoculars or they don't need a telescope to enjoy?
So one thing I would love for everybody to do, especially in the summer, so you could do this in the morning now, but if you wait until June, July, August, and you go outside and you look right towards the south, you'll see a group of stars. It's the Scorpion, and it makes this very distinct S, and it has a red star in the middle. It's called Antares, which is really anti-Mars. So it's red and easy to confuse with Mars. Now, when you find that, if you take that S and just kind of jump off, you'll see another little constellation there. It looks like a teapot. Pointing in that direction, okay, again, no telescope here, you're just outside looking. Point in that direction, you're pointing towards the center of the galaxy. So right toward, that way you are going all the way towards the center of the galaxy. So if you remember, solar system, that's a system of planets. Mm-hmm. Well, just like our planet is in a system of planets, our star, the sun, is in a system of stars. And there are many systems of stars out there, all of these galaxies. And one thing I'd like for people to keep in mind is that 100 years ago was when we discovered that galaxies even exist.
Wow.
It was just 100 years ago that we figured out that some of these things that we were seeing deep in the night sky were actually other systems of stars. And so if you think about some of your favorite people in history, right, or if you just think of somebody like Teddy Roosevelt, not very long ago, Teddy Roosevelt did not know about galaxies, right? So really think about where we are right now in our understanding of the universe, how fast we've come from, not really understanding very much in a few hundred years, and really think about where we are going. When you see things like the James Webb Space Telescope, we are learning so much. It is an amazing time to be alive in the world of astronomy.
So you talked about the telescope events you have down at Wheeler Farm. Are those open? Can other astronomers bring their telescopes there?
Yes, and we've just launched this last year. This year we will also be launching a volunteer program. So starting in May, people can actually volunteer and come out and help us with the telescopes. And so if you don't know how to use a telescope, that's a way that you could actually learn and then help other people. And if you have a telescope, you can bring that out. We would appreciate it if you would just let us know, chat with us beforehand, and then we can really help you get the most out of that night.
Yeah, I have to say, they used to have a telescope party up here out at Trailside years ago, and I learned so much about navigating the night sky, utilizing my telescope filters, everything that I didn't know I needed to know from volunteering at these. And so if you have a telescope, contact the Clark Planetarium and go down, because you will learn so much.
You will learn so much, and again, if you volunteer, a way that people really learn is when they teach others. Mm-hmm. And so if you are out there learning how telescopes work, and then you can start teaching other people how telescopes work, and not only that, but how the night sky works, what are stars? What are we looking at when we're looking at a globular cluster, right? What's the difference in this type of cluster and this type of cluster? What is this planet? When you are learning that, and then you get to turn and you get to teach other people what you're actually seeing, that's when you're learning more.
Just a quick question before we let you go, Jason, and it has to do, a minute ago you talked about the apps that you can use, and I grabbed my phone to try to remember which one I downloaded. Are they pretty accurate? It just feels like when you point your, you know, you point your phone up with the app to the night sky, it just seems like, I just questioned whether or not it was the real thing.
So I use one called Sky Guide.
Okay.
And it does take a minute to kind of load. So when you look at it, just know that you might be looking at, you know, the last time you used it, right? So it's kind of holding something there, and then you just give it like 30 seconds, and then it'll update. Now, of course, it's you also have to recognize that sometimes they're not perfectly aligned. So maybe you have to look at that and say like, oh, wait, that's Leo, and it's just a little bit over. So you have to do a little bit of adjusting. It's always, you know, we're always perfecting, but I think that it is better than the classic planispheres, but some people still love to use those. That's where you just have like a little chart and you're able to move to the day and time of year. I remember, you know, when I was a kid though, I grew up in a very rural place, and boy, the sky was so dark. There were so many stars, I couldn't make heads or tails out of any of that. So I would recommend, you know, downloading an app, checking it out. But don't be shy and stop by the planetarium and chat with people. And, you know, go to the Wheeler Farm, check out maybe volunteering, check out one of our night vision shows where we simulate the night sky on the dome, and you can ask questions. Stop by, talk to us. We're all there. We're all just excited to talk to everybody about what they would like to know about and how they would like to connect with the universe. Again, this could be science fiction. You might really be, you know, loving Star Trek, Star Wars, or a book you read, and you just want to share that, stop by, talk about it, absolutely.
I think it's great. Yes, the Clark Planetarium is for more than your third grader field trip, which I'm a little ashamed to say maybe the last time I went was when my one of my kids was there on a field trip. It's for everyone. It's there. Lots of great resources. Really, really exciting stuff.
Well, we'd love to have you back. We'd love to have you for the week of Full Steam Ahead. If you come in on May the 4th, be with you. Be sure to wear your Star Wars costume. Or if you'd love to see Phil Plait, I highly recommend that. We do expect it to sell out, so please go to our website and buy tickets as soon as possible.
Let's do that, Katie.
I know, I think we should. Well, Jason Sills, Associate Director of the Clark Planetarium, thank you so much for joining us. Thanks for trekking up in this weather. We really appreciate it, and congratulations to 20 years. Where can people go to find out more information about the Clark Planetarium and about the events you have coming up?
Yep, clarkplanetarium.org, or you can just Google Clark Planetarium.
All right, well, thank you. And I highly recommend everyone go down there. It's an amazing place.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.